Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We have someone very new and exciting for you today, Alex. Who have we got on?
We have Lizzie Rogers with us today. She is a PhD researcher. She looks at women's collectors, curiosities in the 18th century, country houses, museums, art, Jane Austen, reading. Now, we had a podcast on the Duchess of Portland, didn't we, and her manic collecting, which people loved. But we're going to talk about elite women and travel in the 18th century. So the women that actually got up and went, which I can't wait for. So, Lizzie, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. I'm excited to talk about some of the fun things these women did.
Oh, I can't wait. I really hope that they like tore the town up. But can you start by telling our listeners who don't know what is the Grand Tour?
I guess, in very simplistic terms, the Grand Tour probably is the original gap year. You find the elite, that aristocracy, kind of top levels of society, traveling around Europe. Young wealthy Europeans, often Western Europe, and their idea is to learn and improve themselves intellectually and culturally, museums, places of interest, visit salons and libraries. But it's got this real, most people see it as young, rich British men drinking and spending their way around Europe.
I like the sound of that. I really do like the sound of that. But
Very fun.
isn't it just something that men did at the time?
So no, actually, it's really interesting when you go into it. Many people travelled from Britain in the 18th century, not just Britain as well, but that's where my research is focused on. Particularly women, and not even just with men. Many women travelled independently, met up with friends on the continent. It's a lot more of an open phenomenon, so to speak. It's just not necessarily seen as a traditional grand tour with the young rich men going. So it is really interesting and a lot more open.
So yeah, I have to ask, what, why is travel important at this time, and what made these women want to go?
So I guess travel meant the exchange of new knowledge, new objects, and meeting new people. It was widely seen in the 18th century that travel was an important part of self-development and the completion of a proper education, which I guess is a lot of the reason why people still go on gap years today. To kind of grow as a person and see new things and see the world for themselves. Because in the 18th century, it meant satisfying curiosity, understanding history, people, oneself, beyond just reading about it at home, having abstract objects coming to the collections and country houses, because they're the people that I've been researching. I think the other thing that's really important to note is that this is very much linked to the Enlightenment, which is. I mean, it's in very simplistic terms. The Enlightenment meant understanding for oneself and literally enlightening oneself with new knowledge. So going and traveling and seeing these places for yourself meant that you were being really active in how you learn and how you educated yourself, and you could share this knowledge with others and meet new and exciting people. So it was very much part of like education and learning, but also elite leisure and pleasure as well.
So how did women typically get to travel at this time?
So women found their way there independently. They met up with friends and went with family. So one of the women I've been researching, Henrietta Fermor, who was the Countess of Pomfret, she travelled with her husband and some of their children. I think mainly because they were searching for a cheaper life on the continent, because it was cheaper to be there than in England. And following the death of Queen Caroline in 1737, she'd been a lady of the bedchamber to her. They travelled all across Western Europe, and she wrote these wonderful letters to her friend, the Countess of Hertford, and who stayed at home. So it's really interesting tracking her journey. And actually, the Countess of Hertford's daughter was Elizabeth Percy, the first Duchess of Northumberland, who I think is possibly one of my favourite women in history. She's one of my favourite women in history because she's so outspoken and opinionated in her diary. And she travelled a lot. She travelled with her family. She travelled on her own and met up with people on the continent, particularly after she finished being Lady of the Bedchamber to Queen Charlotte in 1770. And although I've not researched others as much, people went on the Grand Tour with their husbands just after they got married. Sarah Fanshawe from Uppock House in West Sussex went with her husband, and they have these wonderful Pompeo Bertone Grand Tour portraits. In fact, she has two. I don't know how she wrangled two different ones, and they're both beautiful. And then you've got the group of ladies from Alleronde. They went for a decade travelling, and then they come back and they have this wonderful house that's filled with souvenirs that they made. So it's really interesting how they all find their way there and the people they meet.
That sounds amazing, the 10-year jolly with the souvenirs.
I know, it'd be so cool. I'd love that.
We're going to get into some great stories of where these women went and what they got up to. But before, can I just ask, being women and this being the 18th century, was it dangerous? And are there any horror stories?
I imagine there probably would be. There aren't too many in the sources that I've been reading. One thing they do though is they do complain a lot about the typical young male grand tourists, about their drunkenness, and so I guess they're things that they've seen as they traveled around. That's not to say there weren't any horror stories. I've read I think about 5 or 6 different accounts, and maybe they left them out, but my favorite thing is that the Councillor Parkford wrote when she'd seen some male grand tourists kind of ripping up the boards in one of the cities she'd been in, that most of our travelling youth neither improve themselves nor credit their country, which I think is really interesting. They obviously think they're better and having a more refined time than the men that were going travelling.
Isn't that always the case though? Women are a little bit more chilled and guys are just like, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen some of those hen parties.
Oh, no. That is very true, actually. That is very true.
Wouldn't put it all at the feet of mankind. But tell us, where did these women go?
It's really interesting. I mean, I'd love to take one of these holidays, and I kept joking that I would do it in the name of, you know, research and understanding the women I was researching, but I never did it. So typical itineraries focused on France or Switzerland to learn French mainly, followed by Italy, and most notably it would be Venice, Florence and Rome to look at Italian antiquities and art and architecture of the Renaissance. I mean, it's not completely rigid though, because people did go to Russia or Turkey, the Mediterranean and the Nearer East, as well as Scandinavia, Iberia and Eastern Europe. And particularly in the second half of the 18th century, there's a lot more improvements to roads and accommodation and transport, which more and more people could go and they could see more new places. And one of the diaries I read was for a Winifred Constable, who's she lived at Burton Constable near Hull, and she went on a grand tour for 2 years, and she didn't write much in her diary, but one thing she did write was exactly where they went in sequence. So in just under 2 years they went from England to France, then to Belgium, then spent almost a year in Italy, and they visited Turin, Milan, Bologna, Florence, Naples and Rome, which sounds so perfect. And I think also the Netherlands and Germany were quite popular, particularly the Netherlands for art as well. The Dutch of Northumberland discussed as collecting art and going to see other collectors there as well. So it's quite wide ranging. They're all going all across Europe.
What are some of the sites that they describe?
So it's very much, I mean, it's very similar to, I think, the things we would pick out if we were going. So there's lots of galleries and museums because they want to learn about the history and their place and the history of the world. And also galleries and museums for women were a kind of safe place for them to go and display their good taste, which represented kind of their private virtue as well. And there's some really cool illustrations of museums, like the ones they would have visited. So you have these kind of cabinet of curiosities, and there's a really famous picture of one, and it's called the Museum Wormianum, which was published in 1655. The collector was called Old Worm, which is possibly the best historical name ever. And you can see loads of the rare specimens they would have seen, and they're all their arrangement. They've got a narwhal tusk and things like that, and there's books on show, which is really interesting. But some of the others show people in them as well, using the collection. So there's a collector called Levinus Vincent, and he was Dutch too. And he had a catalogue called his Wonder Theatre of Nature. And he worked in conjunction with his wife, to Joanna van Breda, to construct his collection. And in this picture from the catalogue, you've got men and women wandering around this huge hall, and there's all these like specimens out on the table, and they're all in conversation. And it's shown to be like a really social thing to go and learn and look at these objects and kind of immerse themselves in this history. So you go and see kind of collections like this, but then they also are going to see ancient history in places like Rome. So the Countess of Pomfret writes about going to visit the Colosseum, and she writes that she's trying to imagine the gladiators fighting the animals and the thousands and thousands of people who would have been watching. And so it conveys this idea that I think we still see today as Rome being a living museum, which I think is really, really cool, that they're having the same kind of experiences that we do when we travel. And they were quite knowledgeable about some of these places, and they were also very opinionated about them. So when the Countess of Pomfret was in Rome in April 1741, she goes to the Barberini Palace, and I want to quote what she says because I just think it's really funny. She says, "The objects on show were so crowded and ill-kept, they appear a heap of fine things going to ruin as fast as possible." So, you know, she doesn't think they put them on display quite so well. And a few days later, she goes to another collection of a private individual, and she says that the state rooms are small, dark and dirty, and they're full of, and she, this is a quote, "bad statues and unframed pictures." And then she complains that this gallery that would have been really painted and beautiful was now covered with mold and emitted no very agreeable smell, saying that it did not look like the collection of a nobleman, which I think is quite funny.
This is like TripAdvisor for the 18th century, isn't it?
It literally is, honestly. I was in stitches when I was reading it, and I wasn't quite expecting some of the opinions, but they were absolutely brilliant. They kind of remind you that they're real people who have likes and dislikes when they're going. And actually, something she does write about in a very complimentary way that was really lovely to read is... So the Countess of Pomfret, she goes to Germany. When she's in Innsbruck, she goes to Ambras Castle, which has a huge collection of the 16th century Archduke Ferdinand II. And she was so impressed by the curiosities that he'd assembled and that had been built upon by his successors, that she writes all this huge description of exactly what's in, I think it's 18 successive rooms. There's armour, cabinets, natural history specimens, ivories, clocks, miniatures, minerals, antiquities, the lot. And she said that she stood there and just stared at them for ages, because when she left Italy, she didn't imagine to travel north and see anything like that. And she didn't expect the German princes to be as kind of intellectual and as wide-ranging as the Italians. But she writes that, "but by experience, I find that virtue and knowledge are the growth of every climate, as well as vice and ignorance, and travelling convinces one of this truth." So I think it's really interesting that she's learning about all these different places and has this surprise that there's so many interesting things to see everywhere, not just on the typical Grand Tour route.
So in your research, who is your favourite person that you found?
I would love to say that I love them all equally, but I think it's definitely the First Duchess of Northumberland. She is my absolute favourite. And any excuse to like write or talk about her, because she left behind so many pages and pages of diary and full of opinions and really vivid descriptions as well, which is really helpful. But yeah, she just seemed like such a character, which is fab, absolutely fab.
So go on then, tell us all about her. Who was she, where did she go, and what did she see?
So she was actually a surprise heiress. So she's linked to Alnwick Castle, Sion Park, and they also had Northumberland House in London, which is no longer there. So she had an older brother, but he died before her, and then her father died. So she becomes this heiress, and she's really interested in her family history, and it's something that she's inherited from her family. If you go to Alnwick Castle today, they have a museum that was kind of formed by the Dukes, and they have all these really interesting bits in there about all the different successive generations that were really interested in history and collecting. So it's almost like a huge family endeavour. And when she was traveling across the continent, she went and visited all sorts of people. She met the philosopher Voltaire in his house in 1772. And she writes about him that she goes with this group of friends and they have a really great time. And she describes that he has a fire in his eyes. I never saw in those a man of 25, and that he has slightly an entertaining conversation. But then at the end, she writes this note that what she liked about him as well was that he walked her back to her carriage. So not just that they'd had this great conversation, but that he'd waited upon her right until the end. And she loved the party as well. They had people queuing out of their doors at Northumberland House in London because they just invite loads and loads of people to these fabulous parties and things. So I think she would have been a really fun person to know in the 18th century.
Is the 10-year one the longest one you found?
Yes, that's the longest one I've found. And I think I don't know much about the Parminter ladies. Freya Gowley's done some fabulous work on Alerond, because it's a magical place. But yeah, they went as a group and kind of travelled. And I think they chopped and changed a little, the core group. Yeah, they went for 10 years, which I think is incredible, to be honest.
And then they all came back and lived in one's house.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not entirely sure exactly who went into the house, but it was a house that was those women, and they filled it with all their kind of souvenirs and curiosities and lots of shell work and interesting furniture and things as well.
That's just so like beautiful. My life ambition now, just to carry
I know, I would just
a house full of the stuff.
Exactly, it'd be such a cool place. And then when people come to visit, they're like, oh yes, I got this in this place when I was traveling there.
The women who were left behind, how did they benefit from the experiences of women tourists?
So I think this is really interesting. It's something I got really into because the Countess of Pomfret writes these letters to her friend, the Countess of Hertford, over the three-year period she's away. And the Countess of Hertford stays at home, although it's important to mention that she herself says in her letters that it's not her gender that was the barrier to travel, it was her health and situation in life at the time. But it's so interesting because you get all these beautiful accounts that the Countess of Pomfret's written, and then you get the Countess of Hertford writing back, basically, she's been reading all about these places, and she's been really spurred on to learn about them because her friend's there. And she uses this really beautiful phrase that she travels only on the wings of the imagination. And she has all these passages that she writes that basically say she's used her imagination to be there. And she clearly thinks travel is very important as well, because she writes to her friend that people who live only within a circle of a few friends entertain narrow opinions and unjust prejudices against whatever is outside their sphere of knowledge. But she thinks that truth, good sense and reason are much the same in all places. So she obviously thinks it's very important but can't go herself. So she really benefits from this discussion with her friend. And her friend who is on the continent, the Countess of Pomfret, she focuses on all the things, and she writes such detailed descriptions that they almost place you there because she focuses on all the senses and everything. And she talks a lot about objects and about people, and there's some lovely little passages that show the depth of their friendship. So she writes that when she's in Rome and she was visiting a collection, it would be endless to enumerate it. And as they are engraving and will be published an account of them, if you care for it, I will bespeak a set for you. So she keeps offering to send these back so her friend can share in the experience, even though she's effectively traveling. I think there's a really great phrase, it's called armchair traveler. So she's effectively traveling from her living room, which, to be honest, I didn't realize how relevant that was until now. Because I feel like we've all been doing a lot of that. I've spent a lot of time on like Google Street View and things when looking at all these places that I wish I was in, but I'm actually just at home. I'm just wishing I was at all these cool places. And there's another thing that she eventually does send her friend a set of vases that she commissions for her in Florence. And when they arrived at the Councillor Parfitt's house, they're adored not only for their craftsmanship and because they've come from this place that she herself can't be in with her friend, but also because they represent their friendship, and she assures her that that enhances their value beyond the artistic merit. And it shows they're kind of sharing in this European world of collecting and art and trying to understand all the kind of cultural and intellectual things going on. It's so lovely to read, but also a little bit, I guess, heartbreaking to see that she couldn't have the same kind of experience because of her situation. But she, about the vases, she writes back, "Oh, I have not a room in my house worthy of them, no furniture good enough to suit with them. In short, I found 1,000 wants that have never entered my head before. I'm grown ambitious and want to change my bergerie for a palace and to ransack all the cabinets in Europe for paintings, sculptures and other curiosities to place with them." So I guess this kind of the focus on having objects that are from these places is so important because they feel like they have a piece of them there with them.
So you've read, clearly you've read a lot of different tours. If you could repeat any of them, which one would it be?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually. I think it probably, even though the Duchess of Northumberland is my favourite woman, I think it would be the tour that the Councillor Pomfret took, because she just sounds to have like picked up on some really interesting things. Like she met a historian of the Medici family in Florence, and she goes and sees, like, she talks about as if it's like an archive and goes and chats to him about the history. She goes and visits and I think my favourite bit from their tour is she visits the, I think it's the second ever woman to have a PhD. She's the first woman to hold a science professorship. So this is in 1741, and this woman's called Laura Bassi. And the first woman to ever hold a PhD was Italian too, Eleanor Cornaro. And I think that's probably the one thing I would have loved to have done. She goes to this Laura Bassi's house, and they have this discussion with her, and she comes away and she's like, this woman is a genius, and she's so interesting, and she's also very virtuous in how she portrays herself. And her friend writes back to her that it would have made her so happy if she could have been there too. So I think that probably is the moment I would have wanted to be there, as well as all these really interesting collections that they visited, to see the things there. And yeah, in these rooms that they describe where they're all things are towered on top of each other. I think it must have been so interesting.
Is there any place that you've read that they went to that is not there anymore that you would have loved to have seen?
I guess some of these collections aren't there in the same way that they saw them. I'm not exactly sure if there's any specific places, but there are definitely, they talk about collectors that they went to see and their collections, and I want to do some more digging to see if they're still there. The Duchess of Northumberland goes to a collector in, I think it's Amsterdam, and she talks about him, and she actually talks about him more than the collection, because he really fascinates her. I mean, she's a really aristocratic, like top level of society woman who's a collector, and she meets this man who's very rich, but he made his family money from a draper's shop, and he still goes and works in there even though he's really rich, and he's sending people off to buy art and curiosities. And his collection sounds so interesting that I really want to know if it's still there and people still visit it. I mean, I imagine it's probably been dispersed now, but I think that's probably the thing that I would wish was still there, is all these places they saw that were like rooms after room. It makes me think of going to visit the Vatican Museum, where it's just room after room of amazing things, and you kind of get so overwhelmed walking around that by the end you're just like, how are there so many treasures in one place, I guess.
I've asked about the most exciting. I mean, you've got to have one that is, you've just read and gone, oh my God, this is so awful, this is rubbish,
yes. This
is really boring, and I wish I could get the reading over with. Tell us about that one.
Let me have a think. I guess they have a few where they're just like, oh, we've come to this collection and people have told us it's amazing and it's just covered in dust and there's nothing here of note. And there's There's one actually, I mean, the Duchess of Northumberland does actually say some quite good things about it, but she's, I think it's when she goes to Germany and she's in Mannheim Palace, and she starts saying that she likes the collections there, but to be honest, her collections are just as good. I think she talks about like the ivories and things like that. And I think it's in the same place. Yeah, when she visits the Royal Palace at Mannheim, where she said she lists a few things that she sees that she thinks are quite cool. So she sees like a stuffed zebra, but then she says that was the only pretty one, and says that the rest of the collection, and this is a quote from her diary, was a parcel of monsters. And I really want to know what she means by this.
Do you think they were just really badly stuffed animals that are all like...
I think it must have been. She says something about this things with three heads, and I'm like, well, they must have just been sewn together and things like that. But I think that's a really good one. But she's just like, oh wow, what is this kind of thing?
Can you imagine if there's some weirdo collector out there just stitching bits of animals together, like taxidermy?
I know.
That's really gross, Alex.
That's what I'm guessing she's on about.
I mean, you never know. She did quite like that collection, but some of it just makes me laugh with Ray, the parcel of monsters at the end. I just really want to know, like, what was going through her head when she wrote that.
That sounds brilliant. What do you think the legacy is of these women, these adventurous women?
I think their legacy is a lot of them did bring back items and collectibles from their grand tours, if to call them that, rather than just travelling. But not only that, I also think that there's... I guess it's less of a physical legacy, but also a kind of intellectual and cultural legacy, that they were engaging in lots of interesting conversations and meeting lots of interesting people. And they're participating in these kind of cultures of knowledge exchange and learning new things. And I think that's a really important part of the legacy as well of travel. I mean, they even talk about it themselves, that, you know, it's opening up their opinions and they're sharing these ideas with each other. So I think that's a really important side of the legacy. And I think also it's really interesting when you look at these objects that are still in country houses today and recognise that that the treasures in these houses are not just all bought by the young men who went on the grand tour, because I think there is a little bit sometimes a simplistic idea that that's the case, and in actual fact a lot of women did bring things back, and also they bought things in conjunction with their partners and husbands as well. So example, art collecting, Boughton House in Northamptonshire, Countess of Cardigan goes on her Mary Montagu. She goes on a grand tour with her husband, so to speak, or she travels to Europe anyway, and they go and buy art together, and it's like a shared interest for them. And they're not the only case of that. And I think it's just really interesting to see that sometimes it's not remembered as such, but if you delve into the sources a little bit and read some of these things, you see actually these women are participating in some really interesting things that still impact country houses and kind of collections today.
Is there anything local people can see, like right now, without breaking obviously lockdown rules, if they've been inspired by the podcast?
Very important. Well, a lot of the Duchess of Northumberland's collection has been broken up, and obviously Northumberland House, where she had it, isn't there anymore. But when, hopefully, my favourite, Boughton House, when that reopens, that's full of a lot of interesting art, and the Buccleuch collection, which includes Boughton, and I think it's John Lamrig in Scotland and a few others, they have a Leonardo da Vinci painting that I think it was on loan to the National Gallery of Scotland, but I'm not sure if it still is. I need to double check that. But they had this Leonardo painting that the two of them bought, Madonna of the Yarmwinder. And that's something that I think is really, really interesting and really cool.
Izzy, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about some of these really awesome women, not so awesome men, some beautiful collections and some really funny stories. So thank you so much for that.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Join us tomorrow when expat Lawrence Robinson talks all about Finland and the kinship wars. You think that Finland didn't have anything to do with World War One and that nothing was really going on? You couldn't be more wrong. There's a lot of complicated place names, but a lot of really interesting stories about what was happening immediately post-World War One in Scandinavia. So don't miss that.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.